Pretty scary, huh? Okay, welcome to the beginning of the live broadcast day. It's 1500 hours, 3 o'clock p.m. Pacific time. Here in Santa Cruz County, California, you are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz. And this is the Mideast Migraines Program.
Today is Monday,
coming up next in
This is the Mideast Migraine program, folks, on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Don't run away. Just to let you know, you're listening to a couple of tracks from my wonderful The Musicians of the Nile, Luxor to Izna CD. 1989 Real World Records. These are the closing minutes of O Bird Upon the Tree. And that was preceded by Rejoicing in Upper Egypt, the belly dancing music that I began the program with. I am Ren Tuwil, your friendly local neighborhood Palestinian American on FRSC. We broadcast at 101.3 on the FM dial and stream live at freakradio.org. If you happen to be listening to your radio now, just keep in mind when you go to freakradio.org, click on the listen link and follow the instructions so that you may pick up our free online stream, or just click on the red oval atop the transmission tower there. Phone lines are open. Area code here in Santa Cruz County in the Central Coast of California is 831. Area code for both lines, 831. Line number one is 427-3772. Again, line one is 427-3772. Likewise, in terms of both telephone lines going directly to me here in the studio live today, line number two is 469-3119. 469-3119. As I jockey my professional-sounding radio voice into position here. Okay, I'll try not to bore you. Here is a short, as in 24 and a half minute long, press TV video about the latest flotilla into the Gaza Strip, which was stopped short a week or two ago by the Israelis. This was recorded, I believe, before the stop shortingness of it occurred. It's called The Sun Will Rise.
Hello, welcome to The Sun Will Rise. I'm Roshan Mohammed Saleh. The Gaza Strip is often described as the biggest open-air prison in the world, besieged and regularly bombed by Israel on one side and blockaded by Egypt on the other. 80% of population are now dependent on humanitarian aid. 63% of young Gazans are unemployed, and 95% of the water is unfit for human consumption. But now, in an attempt to put the international spotlight back onto the humanitarian catastrophe unfolding there, a group of around 50 international activists are setting sail from Europe for the port of Gaza. As the brutal siege approaches its ninth year, today we'll be discussing the Freedom Flotilla's prospects for success. But first, here's Ashraf Shannon from Gaza with a report on how the siege is affecting ordinary Palestinians.
The Israeli blockade has caused great suffering for 1.8 million Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip. In place since 2007, the blockade has made unemployment and poverty rates to reach alarming levels. All sectors in the blockaded coastal enclave have been negatively affected, including farming and fishing. But the hardest hit, due to the illegal and inhumane Israeli blockade, are patients who can't find proper treatment in the Gaza Strip. This is the case of Hamza Hadidi, an 8-year-old boy whose leg was shattered in a car accident last year. Israel has denied Hamza an exit permit, preventing him from getting proper treatment abroad.
I go to the outpatient clinic every 2 days, and they only change the bandages. This morning I was there, and soon after I felt so much pain in my leg. I had my mother remove the bandage because I couldn't bear the pain anymore.
Hamza had multiple failed surgeries in Gaza due to lack of medical expertise to treat such cases. His father says only an advanced medical center abroad can help his son.
The doctors told me that Hamza cannot be treated in Gaza. Hamza needs multiple very complicated surgeries and special implants that are not available in Gaza. A German medical team visiting Gaza told me that he needs a very special treatment abroad that could last for up to 9 months.
The air, land and naval blockade of Gaza has been the longest in modern history. As the Israeli blockade draws near to its ninth year, many here say they feel as if the world has forgotten about them and they have no one to turn to amid the international silence. Ashraf Shannon, The Sun Will Rise, Gaza.
To discuss the significance of this new Freedom Flotilla, which is setting sail for Gaza, we have two guests with us today. Zaha Birawi is the coordinator for the International Committee for Breaking the Siege of Gaza. This is a Palestinian initiative to mobilize the international community to act immediately to stop the Israeli siege. And Laura Stewart is a Palestine human rights activist who describes herself as a British Mavi Marmara survivor. That's a reference to the Turkish boat which she was on, which was attacked by the Israeli military in 2010, leaving 10 people dead and more than 50 wounded. So welcome, both of you, to the show today. Thanks for coming in today. Zaha, if I can start with you. Tell me about this latest Freedom Flotilla. Where is it now? What are its plans?
First of all, Roshan, let me say to the Palestinian father and his son that we will never forget them. And we, as International Committee for Breaking the Siege in Gaza and all the alliance in the Freedom Flotilla Coalition, we are working day and night in order not to forget them and in order to awake those who are forgetting them. The Freedom Flotilla Coalition, as you know, started this year from the north of Europe, from Sweden. Early May, they sailed from there to Copenhagen, then to Germany, then to Spain, to France, then to Spain. Yeah. And now they are in the south of Spain, in Mortil port. Today there will be a good celebration welcoming them in that port, and to get ready for the next step. The next step or the next stop will be in Italy, and after Italy we're going far to the east of Mediterranean in order to meet with the rest of the boats. Sure. In order to depart towards Gaza.
But this isn't going to be easy, is it? Because as we know, Mavi Marmara got attacked in 2010. Then there was another attempt in 2012. Also, that was stopped by the Israelis. I mean, what are the prospects of this actually reaching Gaza? Not good, right?
Let me say that we know the difficulties of being on board of such boats.
Yeah.
And we know at the same time that the mission deserves our trial. We must keep trying to break this inhumane siege on Gaza. And we believe that the Israelis, they will act maybe the same as they did regarding the Mavi Marmara or the other, the second flotilla. But that will not stop us from trying. The Israelis are going to be the losers if they try to attack this flotilla again. Mm. Because during the first one, until now, Israel is suffering from what happened in 2010,
yeah,
politically, I mean, and in their relation with mainly the biggest Islamic country, which is Turkey, and other countries in the world, still criticizing Israel for what happened. Sure. Against Mavi Marmara and the Freedom Flotilla 1.
Laura, you were on that boat, the Mavi Marmara, in 2010. Yes. when it got attacked. I mean, given your experiences, I mean, how do you feel about these guys trying to do it again? Would you go on one again?
I certainly would. I tried to get on the one, I think, the one following that was stopped in Greece from leaving the ports by lawfare, as they call it. I'm not sure how they bribed the Greek government, but they managed to prevent that one from leaving the ports. I was in Istanbul ready to go on that. So, yes, definitely I would go again. I think this is a whole different experience on a little boat like this. I believe they've been pitching and rolling their way around from
what
Northern
kind of people
Europe.
Go on these trips? Are they just pro-Palestinian activists that are very motivated to... I mean, what kind of mindset do you have to go on one of these...
You have to believe in
missions.
Justice. You have to believe that justice is achievable, and you have to believe that the people taking an action... where the governments won't, because all of our governments are complicit in the siege and complicit in the occupation. And so we need the people to continue doing this until it reaches a critical mass that can change.
But it's symbolic, isn't it? I mean, the aid that they're actually carrying on the boats is negligible, isn't it? It's more of a publicity stunt to put the spotlight on the siege,
no,
right?
I think that they're carrying solar panels, which is very symbolic, because if you know about Nafees Ahmed, who was sacked by The Guardian for writing about the gas offshore from Gaza and how Israel has made a vow that they'll not allow Palestinians ever to be independent from Israel with electricity, with power, with all of these resources, or to profit from their own resources under the sea.
Okay.
Then you see how our government was helping the PA as well and British Gas to try and make a deal behind the back of the Gazan people, behind the back of the Palestinian people there.
Okay.
So you've got to break through the siege. Who knows? Maybe that's one of the reasons that they don't
we're
allow the ship to go.
Pick this up in a few minutes' time, but we're going to move on for the time being. Sorry to cut you off there, Laura. We've been collating the messages you've been leaving for us on social media relating to the Freedom Flotilla and other recent events in Palestine. So here's Camelia Shambayati with the social media roundup.
Hi and welcome to our social media roundup. So there's been mass online support for the third Gaza Freedom Flotilla and his footage of the Scandinavian aid ship Marianne arriving to Portugal en route to Gaza. The ship set sail on May the 10th, along with other boats from Greece, Norway, Italy, Canada, South Africa, Spain and Turkey, in an attempt to bring humanitarian aid to the Palestinian territory and bring the 9-year-long siege imposed by Egypt and Israel to an end. Moving on now, there's been tremendous backlash on social media from Palestinians and their supporters against the Palestine Football Association, who had a chance to suspend Israel from FIFA but backed out at the last minute with the creation of Twitter hashtags such as Red Card Jibril Rajoub and Sold Out Jibril. If we take a look at a couple of tweets, Susie from the UK says, the PA, referring to the Palestinian Authority there, have showed unbelievable weakness by dropping the FIFA bid ban on Israel. The PA are not fit to lead the Palestinians. They deserve better. And even Hamas tweeted from their official accounts saying, we condemn the PA's last-minute dropping of the bid to ban the Israeli occupation from FIFA. This move is inexplicable, to say the least. Finally, a disturbing YouTube video that was recently uploaded shows Israeli soldiers breaking the arm of a Palestinian activist. According to the International Solidarity Movement, in Beit Umar, just north of Al-Khalil Hebron, Israeli troops broke the arm of local activist Yusuf Abu Maria and then arrested him. Yusuf was protesting with a group of around 30 local Palestinian activists outside an illegal Israeli settlement. And the Israeli forces continue to violently arrest Yusuf, even though his cries of pain were obvious. Okay, that's all the social media news I have for you this time. Please do check out our Facebook and Twitter pages to keep up with the latest on the show.
Zaha, before we talk about the flotilla again, I just want to briefly pick up on the Palestine Football Association not kicking Israel out of FIFA. I mean, they had the votes to do it, didn't they?
Yes.
What happened?
Unfortunately, the Palestinian Authority, they are taking all opportunities to let their people down.
Mm.
And not only the Palestinians have been let down by this decision, but the international community who are supporting Palestine and who were very happy that it is the time for them to kick out Israel from the
Why didn't they do it? Was some pressure put on Jibril Rajoub at the last minute?
Definitely. When a government rolled by individuals like Mahmoud Abbas and his allies, it is easy for the Israelis and the Americans to put the pressure on them and to take the decisions from them as easy as okay. what Jibril has done.
All right, back to the flotilla, because we're running out of time. I want to get as much in this section as possible about the flotilla. So you wanted to say something about the people on board.
Yes, actually this flotilla is supported by many politicians in the world, and we have more than 50, as you said in your report, of the politicians and public figures on board this time. One of them is the former president of Tunisia.
Yeah.
And some other politicians or former politicians from Europe and America. and we have many.
So will they be less likely to attack the flotilla with someone like as prominent as Monsef Manzouki is on it?
We hope so. Especially, we are calling all the governments, and we started sending some letters for officials in European governments, Arab governments, and to everyone. We believe that they might put some pressure on Israel not to attack this this flotilla. And regarding the aid, also, I want to say that the aid we have is symbolic, yes. But that is simply because the mission is not a humanitarian mission or charity mission. Mm-hmm. It is a political message. It is we are requesting in our website and in our communication that we push towards having the Gaza port, Palestine port, to be built, to allow Gaza people to build their boat,
yeah,
and to have a safe passage or pathway to from Gaza to the West Bank, and to lift the siege on Gaza. So it is political campaign and media campaign to increase awareness about the Gaza situation these days.
Laura, I mean, I know that you'll be a Palestine activist till the day you die, but ultimately, this siege is nearly 9 years old now. I think we're coming up to the ninth year of it. And the focus seems to be on it less than any time before. People aren't talking about it. They're talking about Syria, I don't know, or what's going on in Ukraine. But no one's talking about the Gaza siege. Is that a bit dispiriting?
No, I think it's a good thing. I don't think we should be just talking about the siege of Gaza. I don't think we should be talking about two-state solution. In fact, any organisation that I know that would talk about a two-state solution, I think I would be boycotting them, never mind boycotting Israeli goods. I think now that it's clear that the only solution is for the return of all the Palestinian refugees. So I would prefer to focus on the right of return. And obviously, the end of the apparatus of the State of Israel. Mm. And then if the two people live there in peace as they did before. But the land is Palestine. The state is the instrument of oppression. So the State of Israel has to go, and the people can live on the land in peace.
Laura, can I very well put, but can I also ask you personally about the Mavi Marmara case? What is the status of that at the moment? Yeah, they're still looking for some kind of retribution, are they, from the Israeli military or
absolutely?
Or the government?
There was three conditions. One was apology, which Netanyahu did in person to Erdogan. And the second was the monetary compensation, which is for the families. I know some of the families quite well. I mean, that's not an issue.
Yeah.
And the third was lifting the siege of Gaza. One of the main issues about the ongoing court case is that the judge has issued the arrest warrants for the military personnel. However, those arrest warrants are sitting on the desk at the Ministry of Justice in Turkey and have not been sent to Interpol.
Right.
And it was my hope that Erdogan would win the election with a clear majority so that
he'd be in a position to push this.
Yeah. Yes.
But he didn't.
And the problem is that we have, of course, so many civilians willing to take an action like this, but at state level, the situation is not changing.
It hasn't moved yet. Okay, we're going to conclude this discussion in a few minutes' time, but we're going to move on for the time being. We've been collating some of the news from Palestine that you may not have seen on the mainstream media. So again, here's our quick roundup.
Israeli aircraft have bombed the northern Gaza Strip, allegedly in response to a rocket fired from Gaza that hit southern Israel. The rocket landed on open ground and caused no damage or injuries. No casualties were reported in Gaza either, following the airstrike, which struck a Hamas facility. A Salafi jihadist group, the Omar Brigades, who sympathize with ISIL, claim responsibility for firing the rocket at Ashkelon. They said the rocket was in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails and their own members incarcerated in Gaza. An Egyptian's appeals court has cancelled a ruling to list the Palestinian resistance group Hamas as a terrorist organization. Hamas is an offshoot of Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood, which the authorities have also declared a terrorist group and have repressed since the army ousted Mohamed Morsi from the presidency in 2013. Cairo has for many years played a central role in engineering ceasefires between neighboring Israel and Hamas. But it has also been instrumental in tightening the economic siege on Gaza in conjunction with Israel. Palestinians have heavily criticized the Palestine Football Association for dropping its motion asking for Israel to be suspended by FIFA. The motion had been included on the agenda at the FIFA Congress, but PFA President Jibril Rajoub said he had been persuaded to back down. The Palestine FA has accused Israel of hampering its activities and restricting the movement of players between the Israeli-occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And finally, Israeli leader Benjamin Netanyahu has proposed resuming land for peace talks with the Palestinians, but with the initial focus on defining areas where Israel could expand Jewish settlements. Peace talks collapsed in April 2014 over Israeli settlement building in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem, and after President Mahmoud Abbas angered Israel by reaching a unity deal with Hamas in Gaza. A spokesman for Mahmoud Abbas said settlement activity must stop and all core issues of the conflict with Israel must be addressed simultaneously.
Zahra, again, I want to pick up on something in that previous report. Egypt has taken Hamas off the terrorist list. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good news, and why have they done that?
It is a step to the right direction, I think. The Egyptian authorities, they convinced or believed late that they must have some relation with Hamas, because without having the relation with Hamas, there will be no role for the Egyptians in the political process, because Hamas representing most of the Palestinian people, not only in Gaza, in the West Bank also. So 60% or more of the votes gone to Hamas in the latest election happened in Palestine. That means Hamas is a main player in the political scene in Palestine.
So it's about having influence.
So, yes, yeah. And that reflects the decision of the court, reflects that the court is not only acting as a court, but they are influenced by the political scene in Egypt.
As a Palestinian yourself, I mean, we all talk about the Israeli-imposed siege, but Egypt has been equally as instrumental, hasn't it, in blockading Gaza. And it's got even worse since Morsi was ousted, right?
Unfortunately, Egypt are now part of the imposing the siege on Gaza by closing Rafah crossing at least. I don't want to talk about the buffer zone they created lately after the coup against.
Yes.
But at least closing this is not accepted by all the Palestinians unless they are cooperating and benefiting from the siege. Some of the Palestinians, a minority of the leadership of Palestinians, they are cooperating with Egypt and maybe encouraging Egypt to keep this kind of siege on Gaza in order to gain some political gains for their parties or for their selves, okay?
Yeah.
So this is the problem of the siege. The siege is not only Israeli. Yes, it is mainly Israeli, and this decision being taken by the Israelis, as you remember, and everyone remember, after the election in 2006, because the leadership of the Palestinians elected at that time did not please the Israelis or the Americans or their alliance in the region, especially Egypt and the Palestinian Authority. So this is the reason it is unlogical.
But this flotilla is more about, given that it's coming from the sea, and that is not a blockade imposed by Israel,
it's
more focusing on Israel than Egypt,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And this to remind the people that we, as a Freedom Flotilla Coalition, we concentrate on the breaking the siege from the sea. Okay,
right.
But we, as International Committee, for example, for breaking the siege, we are doing convoys, and we used to do many convoys every year until the coup happened in Egypt.
Yeah.
And
now
from
you
that
can't
time
even get
until now,
the
Egyptian authorities did not allow us to go to Egypt.
And it's practically impossible to cross that border, isn't it, now?
Yeah.
I mean, it's open once every few months now, isn't it, for a few days?
Laura,
we're coming to the end of the show now, so I guess I just want to ask you, you know, I mean, what's it going to take? It's a big question, this, but what's it going to take to break that siege?
What's it going to take to break the siege?
The end of Israel?
Well, you've thrown me. Was that one of the questions?
But what can we do as activists? I mean, I don't know. I don't want to sound overly pessimistic here, but are the steps that we're taking, you know, so small that we're never going to get to our ultimate goal? Or how do you see the future?
Let him answer that one.
Exactly. I think it will lead to a good results. This is our hope. And without the hope, we will sit down in our houses and do nothing. So we hope that we can do something. As I said to you, political campaign, media campaign, increasing awareness about it, and encourage the people to do activities and to pressure their politicians, their governments, in order to do something. Yes, I agree. It is not easy to break it by going to Gaza by three fishing ships.
But
it is symbolic, and it is awakening the people in order to do their duty.
How easy has it been to get the international media attention? Are people interested in this?
Unfortunately, it is not very.
It's tough.
But we are trying. At least when we go from port to port in Europe, we have a big celebrations or welcoming events for the boat, and we have local media and we have social media. So if the main corporate are not giving attention to this, but many of the social media, and it is huge, and I think it is influential.
Okay, Laura, anything else you want to say, any kind of, just to conclude? You've got about a minute left.
I'm glad that they're continuing to try and break the siege by sea to prove to the Israelis that they didn't stop us, you know. But to conclude, I was thinking, I want to be on the ships that take the refugees back one day to their land, because the Israelis chased them. Some of them had to leave by sea as refugees, and I would give anything to be on a boat that takes some of them back.
Inshallah, okay. That will happen soon, inshallah.
Okay, great way to conclude. Thanks a lot for coming in today, both of you. And we will kind of, on this show, we'll try and track the updates of this Freedom Flotilla as it approaches, and inshallah, as it enters Gaza this month or next month, I guess. Okay, that's all the time we have for today. Once more, thank you to all our guests. And don't forget to get busy, please, on social media, telling us what you think of the issues raised in this program. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you again next time for more discussion and analysis on Palestine. Bye-bye.
And again, that was a Press TV UK franchise of Press TV. What you call an interview with a couple of folks associated with the International Freedom for Gaza Coalition. That's not the actual name of it, but I do apologize for the, what can I say, thickness of the accents, particularly of the gentleman who is being interviewed. Makes it a wee bit more palatable to be able to watch the video while you're listening to it, but the important thing is, I think you caught our drift just by listening. They, of course, were referring to the latest Freedom Flotilla FF3, Freedom Flotilla 3, attempting to reach the shores of the Gaza Strip, only a day or two after that video was released. The flagship of Freedom Flotilla 3, comprised of four vessels, was stopped, commandeered, and taken on the high seas of international waters, not Israeli waters and not even Gaza waters, in the eastern Mediterranean, and diverted to the shores of Israel, which was not the intended landing point of this human rights, as was stated in the interview, clearly political mission of Freedom Flotilla 3. I do not know what happened to the other three vessels of the flotilla. Perhaps Israel was hoping to dumb down international reaction to their piracy, not that it would have made any practical difference, by attacking only the flagship and not the other three vessels. As far as I know, the other three vessels were not attacked by the Israeli Navy, Israeli naval commandos. I have done so many shows about freedom sailors, the whole Free Gaza movement and its associated partners. I was on the first flotilla of two vessels. We didn't think of ourselves as a flotilla at the time, merely as two vessels in the inaugural maiden voyages of the Free Gaza movement in August of 2008 Israel relented back then and allowed us to reach the shores of Gaza. We carried virtually no supplies at all, virtually nothing that came off the boat and into the hands of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Just a few dozen bottles of water, one single large or moderately sized cardboard box full of hearing aids and perhaps some medications, a fraction of a drop in the bucket in terms of what the medical community needs in the Gaza Strip to heal its many, many cases of sick and injured people, and keeping those who are on kidney dialysis alive. Just a few medicines, the water, and coloring books and balloons for kids. That's all we had. This was 7 years ago. And then a few more voyages occurred. And then Operation Cast Lead happened, where Israel slaughtered some 1,500 virtually unarmed, in most cases entirely unarmed, Gazan civilians there. Made tens of thousands homeless. This was the attack in 2008-2009. And after that, no vessels have succeeded in breaking the maritime angle of Israel's economic siege against Gaza. Now, let me just... Here's another Press TV interview. This one, there is an associated script of an interview with Mary Hughes Thompson, one of my shipmates, in 2008. Let's see if this is... Let me just play the video here, listen to the track, and we'll find out if it's the same thing or not, if the printed version is what's on the video. Israel can't discourage pro-Gaza aid groups.
Ms. Thompson, who is the co-founder of the Free Gaza Movement, and she's joining us live now via Skype from Los Angeles. Ms. Thompson, as always, thanks for joining us. How are you reflecting? It's been a few days now, obviously, since this ship has been seized by Israel. How are you reflecting on what's happened here again, once again, in international waters?
Well, of course, we're very anxious to know that the passengers, 15 passengers who remain imprisoned, we're very anxious to know that they're well. There was apparently brutality, there was violence, notwithstanding the fact Israel said that they were taken without incident, there was no violence. There was violence. They were tased. Anytime you board a ship in international waters and you terrorize and brutalize passengers, you rob them, you handcuff them usually, and then you force them to go against their will to a place they don't want to go to, all done at gunpoint, this is definitely violence by any standards. So, yes, of course, we're very anxious to hear what they have to say about it. And we're outraged, of course, that this was done at all, not that we can be terribly surprised.
Again, this is an interview with Mary Hughes Thompson, a former shipmate of mine, who is being interviewed by Press TV. She is speaking from Los Angeles. Mary is co-founder, one of about a half dozen people who have worked together to found the Free Gaza Movement. And she is discussing the Israeli takeover of the Gaza aid ship, dubbed the Marianne of Gutenberg. The vessel is a Swedish flag vessel, part of the Freedom Flotilla 3. This is the flagship that was taken by Israel last month, forcibly. And let's continue with the interview. It's only another 2 minutes, about 2 minutes more in length.
Just like yourself, brave activists like yourself. Does this deter you?
absolutely not. We first, our first boats went to Gaza in 2008. The Free Gaza Movement got two small boats and we went to Gaza, and the Israelis said they wouldn't let us pass at the time for whatever reason. I think the Foreign Office wanted to let us pass. The Navy wanted to stop us. They thought that it was a one-time thing, that if they just let us go, nobody would know about it. It would never happen again. We'd disappear, and that would be the end of it. Unfortunately for Israel, that's not what happened. We had, from that point on, we've had thousands and thousands and thousands of people begging to go on every boat. We sailed five times in 2008. We landed at Gaza five times in 2008. Once Castlet started, they began to stop the boats. They rammed our boat. It sank. Ultimately, we got another boat. They took that boat. They stopped the boat again. They arrested all the kidnapped the passengers. They've done this several times since then. So each time this happens, even after what happened on the Mavi Marmara, where 10 people were assassinated, the more and more and more people want to go. I think this is part of the problem for Israel. They think that they are going to discourage people by brutalizing them. This does not work. The people who are committed to helping the Palestinians or standing beside the Palestinians do not get deterred. We are not intimidated by threats of violence. We all know that we very well might die in this effort, but that doesn't stop anybody, and Israel doesn't get it.
Very well. We'll leave it there at that, that very valid point. That was Ms. Mary Hughes Thompson, who's speaking to us live from Los Angeles. Ms. Thompson, as always, we appreciate your insight.
Okay, I wanted to play that for you, and now, if I can only, let's see, there are, oh, here it is. That was the second Press TV interview of Mary Hughes Thompson, member of the Free Gaza Movement. Here's an interview with Greta Berlin, I believe. Must be an interview of Greta, another co-founder of the Free Gaza Movement. This is available on YouTube.
The Free Gaza Movement is a human rights group that was founded back in 2006. Their mission is to break the Israeli siege of Gaza. They have just, I'm sure if you follow the news, sent off another flotilla to see if they can break that siege. Greta Berlin is one of the organisers of the Freedom Flotilla. Greta, you've been involved with this movement pretty well from the start, I think.
Yes, actually, my friend Mary Hughes Thompson and me, Paula Rudy, and a couple of other young women from Australia were the original co-founders of the Free Gaza Movement clear back in September of 2006.
It's a very long time that this siege has been ongoing. Israel still insists that there is no siege. And yet, if we look at what's happened to the people on the latest flotilla, one can only say, how can they say there's not a siege when they, I think, actually commandeered the Marianne, which was one of the lead boats in the last flotilla, and forced it to dock in a port it hadn't intended to go to?
Yes, actually, what they did is they hijacked the boat, they kidnapped the passengers, they've stolen the boat, they've stolen all of the equipment, and they still have some of those passengers being held in prison in Israel. And you know why they hold them? They tell the passengers that they had entered Israel illegally, which of course is ridiculous considering the passengers had no intention of ever going to Israel. They were on their way to Gaza.
Well, and they were also taken, were they not, in international waters. Now, I'm really confused about the fact that global leaders are fighting piracy on the high seas, particularly off the Horn of Africa and places. And there are rules of the sea, which, if you're in international waters, I'm not really clear how, anyway, legally, any navy can force a civilian boat to go somewhere else.
Well, they can't, but nobody holds Israel accountable. Israel's been doing this from the moment that they rammed our Dignity, which was clear back in December of 2008, and they rammed it three times in the middle of the night in international waters as we were on our way to Gaza, and no one held them accountable. So between that ramming of the boat in 2008 and now, Israel has managed to capture 8 or 9 boats in international waters and flaunt international law and say to the world, we don't care what the law is, we're going to do what we want to. And this was 100 miles outside of Gaza, clearly in international waters.
What can your organization do about this? I mean, have you thought about going to international courts, or is there a maritime court?
I'm not aware of one. I'm not an attorney, but I do know that Free Gaza is part of a suit that has been brought in front of the International Criminal Court, the ICC, because of the 10 murders on board the Mavi Marmara. In order to take this to a court, you have to have a country that is willing to do that. The Mavi Marmara was flagged in the Comoros Islands, which signed the Rome Statute with the ICC. Turkey has not signed that, the United States, Israel, those countries have never signed the ICC Rome Statute. So you have to be able to have a country that has already signed the statute that will take this to court. And it's still in court. Interestingly enough, the prosecutor at the ICC said, yes, she thought this is what Israel had done. It had committed war crimes. But it wasn't large enough to merit taking to the ICC.
You mean that there should have been more deaths for it to merit the ICC looking at it?
Yes, exactly. I don't know where you draw the line. We had 10. I don't know why you draw the line. Draw the line at 100, 1,000, 100,000. I'm not quite sure where she wants to draw the line. But a law firm in the UK has taken it up again and has asked her to look at it again. That is highly unusual at the ICC, because you have to remember that Palestine has also taken Israel to the ICC just in the last 2 or 3 weeks. So this is going to be very interesting to see what happens. Somewhere along the line, someone's going to hold Israel accountable.
Do you think that the way the Marianne this time round was handled, and the fact that I believe the Israeli Navy boarded the vessel and then forced it to dock in Ashdod, is that a different approach because of the fallout from that last tragic, the Mavi Marmara?
No, they started boarding our boats and forcing them into Ashdod clear back in July of 2009. The Spirit of Humanity was boarded. People were roughed up, passengers were kicked around, and some of them were wounded, and the Spirit of Humanity was pulled into Ashdod. That was true with Freedom Flotilla 1, and it's been true of the many boats that have gone. There's been a Canadian boat that's gone, an Irish boat, a Jewish boat. This particular flotilla was the 15th voyage into Gaza.
Some of the early ones have actually reached Gaza.
Right. Our first 5 trips, we got into Gaza. We got into Gaza. Nobody stopped us. We had already set a precedent that they had no right to stop us. You said something at the very beginning of the program, and I think it needs to be emphasized, and that is that Israel says Gaza is free. If Gaza is no longer occupied, then we have every right to sail into the port of Gaza. We've been asked by the Palestinians to come. And so Israel has no right to stop us. Either they have to admit that they are occupying 1.8 million people, and then they have to treat them kindly, as an occupying force is supposed to, or they have to admit that they're no longer occupying and we have every right to sail in.
And that's the conundrum, isn't it? Because it does seem that there are double standards on this across the Western world.
Yes, there are not only double standards, but nobody's holding, even if somebody is going to take this to the UN, the United States is always going to veto any resolution. I don't remember the exact number of resolutions against Israel right now, but I think it's 70. And the United States has vetoed most of the last half dozen or dozen of those. So Israel sees that the big gorilla in the room, the United States, is going to protect them. So they're just going to do whatever they can get away with, and they are getting away with it.
Where do you go from here? I mean, so many voyages, so many flotillas, and since those early days, certainly, none have... I'm not sure I should say none have been successful, because one of the things I suppose they are doing is drawing attention to the situation. But none have reached their destination.
Right, none have reached the destination, but they are successful. And that's one of the reasons that we continue this. We continue to put Gaza on the front page, if not so much in the United States. It certainly has been true throughout the world that these are always covered. There's been a lot of coverage of the Marianne, because what happened was the Israeli Navy came out and said that it was uneventful. Well, then, of course, we start seeing the videotapes where one nonviolent protester was tasered. They pulled the Marianne into port against its will. They arrested all the passengers. That's not uneventful. And every time that happens, it gives Israel yet another black eye. When we went the very first time, which was August of 2008, that's been, almost 7 years now, we made a promise to the Palestinians. We said that we would return until Gaza was free. And we've honored that commitment 15 times now. Just because we haven't gotten in doesn't mean that we are unsuccessful.
Who are the people who volunteer to go on these boats and, let's face it, with the history, possibly put their lives on the line?
Well, certainly on the first trip, there were 44 of us who got on those two ramshackle boats. I mean, they were pretty, they were old fishing boats. But our Greek partners had said to us, these are two old wooden boats, but you can't sink them. They're really very seaworthy. And they were absolutely correct. That was the case. That was really, I would say, the only voyage out of the 15 that had true activists on board. Most of us on those two boats had worked with the International Solidarity Movement. We had put our feet on the ground. We had lived. We had worked in the occupied West Bank, or we had lived and worked in Gaza. And that was really the very, that was really the time that activists got on the boats and went. After that first trip, it has been a combination of people who would like to go, members of parliament, high-profile people. We're trying to get the media to pay attention. And they're not going to pay as much attention if somebody who's an activist gets on board as opposed to somebody like Nobel laureate Mairead McGuire gets on board. And we know that. So we try to use that to the advantage so that the media will cover it.
You also had a member of the Knesset, I think, on board, and the Tunisian president?
He's the ex-president of Tunisia. And we also had a member of the Knesset on board this time. And we also had Hanin Zoabi, who was also a member of the Knesset, and she was on board the flotilla in 2010 that was attacked.
So what's next, Greta? Do we expect another one in a year or so? Where do we go from here?
That's a very good question. It takes a lot of effort and a lot of money and a lot of time to do this. People are trying to organize from around the world, and that's not an easy thing to do between cultures and time zones. And you can imagine trying to make a phone call in Cyprus, for example, and you're calling Los Angeles, which is 10 hours behind you. They might as well be on the moon. So it becomes really difficult to do a lot of this. It's amazing that we have succeeded as well as we have. And I think that that reason is just sheer determination that we're going to keep Israel's feet to the fire. They are not going to get away with this. And people need to recognize what is happening in Gaza. Do I think another one is going? Well, I read this morning that there's a Moroccan flotilla on the way. That's the first time I had read that this morning.
Is that under your auspices as Free Gaza?
No, and it doesn't need to be. We started it, but we certainly hope that we're not going to finish it. We are hoping that other countries, other initiatives, the Jewish boat to Gaza, for example, wasn't part of Free Gaza. We will support anybody that wants to go. We will provide media help or anything else because we have a long history now of knowing how to do this. We would be thrilled if somebody else went.
And let's just finish, if we may, with telling people about your website, because I know that there are petitions there and a lot more information and presumably places to donate as well, if anyone... if anybody does want to support you. It's www.freegaza.org. And I think you have a Facebook page?
We have a Facebook page. It's just called Free Gaza Break the Siege. And we have another Facebook page, which is called Freedom Sailors. We wrote a book. 24 of the 44 of us wrote a book called Freedom Sailors. And everything that is raised on that goes for projects in Gaza. And it's a great book. I mean, buy it on Amazon. You can download it onto your e-reader. It's lots of fun. It'll make you laugh. It'll make you cry. And you will read it and think, how on earth did they ever get there that first time? And it makes a great story of activist determination in the face of huge, huge difficulties.
Thank you, Greta. You were hearing an interview of Greta Berlin. I've lost it already. Okay. The person performing the interview, her name is Rosie Charalambos, who should not be confused with another woman who is also English and English accented, whose first name also happens to be Rosie. She works for another licensed AM radio station here in Santa Cruz County. That's not the same Rosie. They even vaguely look the same, frankly. But no, this is Rosie Charalambos interviewing, I don't know exactly who she's with, but the date of the interview was July 3, some 10 days ago today, in fact. Okay. Well, it's 4:06 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time here at Free Radio Santa Cruz in on the central left coast of the U.S. here. And played nothing but recorded interviews for you. We are talking so far exclusively about the latest attempt to bring in some human rights workers and precious cargo, which, again, can barely make a dent in the reparations that are sorely needed in the Gaza Strip. Needed not only because of the horrendous military attacks, three such attacks, truly murderous slaughters, three of them over the course of the last 7 years, 6.5, 7 years. Not only because of those out-and-out military attacks upon them by Israel, but because of the truly strained situation with the almost completely crushed Gazan economy, which Israel will not allow to function because of its the strangulating effects Israel has on the ins and outs of into and out of Gaza in terms of badly needed repair parts, food, medicine, fuel, things that will allow the Gazan government and their associated agencies to generate and purify their own fresh water. We heard on the first interview that up to 95% of the available flowing water, whether it's actually flowing right now or not, up to 95% of it is not palatable for human consumption as it is. It has to be further treated on a strictly individual basis. That describes the purpose of these voyages, and of course to break Israel's economic and militarily imposed economic siege on the Gaza Strip. And to bring the world's attention to what's going on there. They make no secret out of that. Now, let's see. A PSA of sorts. You can think of this as a word from our sponsor, ApartheidAdventures.com. We've ran a few of these before, a little bit of levity.
This is what Israel had done. It had committed war crimes. But it wasn't large enough to merit taking to the ICC.
You mean that there should have been more deaths for it to merit the ICC looking at it?
Yes, exactly. I don't know where you draw the line. We had 10. I don't know why you draw the line at 100, 1,000, 100,000. I'm not quite sure where she wants to draw the line. But a law firm in the UK...
We had a runaway YouTube video there. Let's see if I can kick in this apartheid adventures item for you now.
At Apartheid Adventures, we say war crimes, s'more crimes. When you're defending a system of ethnic or religious privilege, otherwise known as apartheid, you have to imprison children, torture people, move your own population of the correct ethnic religious category into an occupied zone, and most of all, you have to target and kill civilians. But here's the good news. It's not a war crime. Just ask us. We'll tell you that we are the most moral army in the world because we have determined the exact number of civilians that we can legally and morally kill, 3.14 civilians per militant. We are not making this up. 3.14 civilians per militant. And best of all, who decides who's a militant? We do. Militants can include government officials or off-duty police officers or teenagers who might someday become militants or people who don't get out of the way of militants or people who have seen a militant anytime lately or who live in the same zone as a militant. So even that exact number, 3.14 civilians killed per militant, has plenty of room for expansion. Why, in the summer of 2014, when we killed over 2,000 people in Gaza, more than 1,400 of them were civilians, but that's still only 2.28 civilians per militant, so we're good. That's right, if you're Israel, killing civilians is okay, and war crimes are not war crimes. So keep on supporting Israel's war crimes with your tax dollars, and keep on supporting our apartheid partners like Elbit Systems, building walls from the West Bank to Arizona, and building more surveillance and lethal drones to keep your privilege safe. Remember that same summer we killed those 1,400 civilians in Gaza? The profits of Elbit Systems went up 6%. War crimes are good for business. And shut up, they're not even war crimes. So that's why we never stop attacking Gaza. We kill an average of 2 children a week in Gaza. Why? Because we can. Apartheid Adventures, ethnic privilege, and we mean it.
I want to get back to before this sucker kicks in at the wrong time here. Pull this back and freeze frame it at the right moment. That did go by pretty quickly, didn't it? It was meant to be seen and as well as heard, obviously. And at one point, very, very quickly, shooting across the screen of this YouTube item, the exact name, if you want to view and hear it for yourself, is War Crimes and Exact Science by Apartheid Adventures. War Crimes and Exact Science on YouTube. For about 1 second, you see a headline on some newspaper published July 22 of last year, 2014. July 22, that couldn't be this July so far. Anyway, by Ami Kaufman, headline, according to an Israeli rabbi, it's okay to kill innocent civilians and destroy Gaza. I can read the first couple of sentences of that here. Dov Lior, a racist Israeli rabbi from the West Bank settlement Kiryat Arba, recently posted a halakhic ruling. Apparently this is something according to someone's idea of Jewish law. The racist Rabbi Dvor Lior from illegal Jewish settlement Kiryat Arba recently posted a halakhic ruling allowing to kill innocent civilians after being asked about the, in quotes, war, it's a massacre, in Gaza. Here are a few lines from the ruling pictured below. Quote, the Torah of Israel guides us in all walks of life, private and public, on how to behave during war and also how to keep, and then there's nothing more available on what little is shown in this brief frame from the Apartheid Adventures, War Crimes, and Exact Science clip that you just heard. Doesn't even say which publication. It simply says it's written by Ami Kaufman from July 22nd of last year. Israeli rabbi, colon, it's okay to kill innocent civilians and destroy Gaza. Truly amazing how people can decide for themselves when and how this supposedly most noble army in the world can descend upon a virtually defenseless, in the end, quite totally defenseless population and kill them. So why does Israel do this? It's a remarkable story. The Gaza Strip, as some of you may recall, and I'm sure this is something that happened long before many of you were even born, attacked the Gaza Strip, which was a small portion, very small coastal enclave of southwestern Palestine. Israel attacked and conquered it at the same time attacking and conquering and for several years succeeding in holding on to all Egyptian land east of the Suez Canal. That's called the Sinai Peninsula. And Israel also managed to establish a number of illegal, according to international law, Jewish civilian settlements for Jews only in the Sinai, Egypt's Sinai Peninsula, which it now occupied by military force, as well as more illegal Jewish-only settlements in the Gaza Strip. This was in June of 1967. It was a surprise attack that Israel very successfully managed to pawn off to the rest of the world as a quote-unquote preemptive strike, supposedly in order to protect themselves, even though the Israeli military and their intelligence apparatus had already determined that neither Egypt nor Jordan nor Syria were in any position to launch any attempt to take over even part of Israel. That is to say, Israel knew full well that with the movement of Arab troops in Arabic lands, but not as yet striking at Israel, that even its leaders, as browbeating as they were in order to rouse the public against things that Israel was doing that they didn't like, President Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt, King Hussein of Jordan, and the leaders of Syria at the time were just trying to scare Israel, and Israel knew it. Israel used this as an excuse to make their surprise attack, their sneak attack, on three fronts, beginning with Egypt in 1967. And Israel also succeeded in taking the balance of Palestine, historic Palestine, the portion of it that is west of the Jordan River, separating the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan from Palestine. In other words, Israel stole the West Bank and to this day holds and has virtual control over every bit of it. And, of course, Egypt still has control over the small sliver of land that it took in the 67 war to the west of the Syrian capital of Damascus called the Golan Heights. That land belongs to Syria as well. Now, why? The question remains, why does Israel continue to assault Gaza and choke the very life, very nearly choking the life out of that enclave, when they made such a ballyhoo over the fact that Israel pulled all of its Jewish civilian settlements out of the Gaza Strip. All they did was they moved them to enforce other existing settlements or expanding existing settlements in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem. East Jerusalem, even, is technically speaking, is being occupied improperly, illegally, under international law. And so why does Israel continue to make life hard for the Gazans, for one thing? And this may be the single prime motivation for Israel to do that. There are fields underwater, undersea fields of natural gas, which happen to lie, in terms of international recognition, within Gazan territorial waters, which is to say fields of natural gas under the land that lies under the sea, which is designated Gazan territorial waters, which is to say Palestinian territorial waters. And we're talking about natural gas, which means that is a natural mineral resource which belongs to the people of Gaza. And that's who it belongs to, technically. And there happen to be a few small fields immediately off of the shores of Israel. The Israelis have for many years now taken advantage of those deposits and have been working with British and other international business partners in extracting the gas from those fields, enriching themselves, and they're not stopping there. Israel wants to control and to take all of the Gazan fields. To a limited degree, Israel has been hiding behind talks of partnerships, including Hamas, including certain Palestinian entities, and not really outright abiding by those agreements. Israel is in the process of taking and really stealing that Palestinian natural resource, just as they are in the process of extracting oil from the Syrian people in the Golan Heights. There have been efforts to take oil, liquid petroleum, out of areas of Syria's Golan Heights that Israel occupies militarily. And so this herein lies the true reason why there's any military activity committed by Israel against Gaza. They do this in an effort to draw all the attention on missiles, mortars, and rockets that do occasionally fly out of portions of the Gaza Strip. Specific areas where Israel has an excellent idea of where most of them come from, and under the guise of defending themselves from these Gazan rockets, they pretty much wipe out the whole of the 35-mile-long whole of the Gaza Strip, attacking willy-nilly, according to many organizations like Amnesty International, the United Nations, other international witnesses, and the Palestinian people of Gaza themselves, in spite of what those people say when they say that Israel is attacking areas and destroying buildings that have nothing to do with armaments, launchers, stashes of ammo, any of that, in terms of rockets being launched into Israel. Israel has learned that largely thanks to the international hegemony of the United States through its Security Council seat at the UN, the United States is going to cover for Israel. The United States is going to make it virtually impossible for the Israelis to be accountable. You heard words from the interviews I played today suggesting that Israel be held accountable for what it does. And no one apparently can make them be accountable for what they're doing. They're drawing, sapping the attention of much of the world, certainly much of the United States, and focusing it all on a few missiles that have really no decent guidance system and rarely hit any kind of a target in Israel. Those missiles over the past 15 years have killed literally fewer than 30 Israelis. I repeat, Gazan missiles have killed fewer than 30 individuals. Operation Cast Lead in December of 08, January of 09, killed some 1,500 Gazans, 1,500, including a couple of hundred children. In November of 2012, the second assault. And both of those so-called wars were politically motivated. Both of them happened weeks before before national elections in Israel. Big surprise, hey? Both of which brought helped to guarantee Netanyahu's continued power there in Jerusalem. The attack in November of 2012 killed over 1,000, including many children, women and children, old people, old men. And, of course, this most devastating attack last summer, which we are commemorating, can't exactly say we're celebrating. We are commemorating this, the beginning of the attack. I believe it actually began in June or July of last year against Gaza. That attack killed over 2,200 unarmed Palestinians, or minimally armed, and even if they had a few guns, the kind that you carry with you at the time, there's no way they could have effectively used them to defend themselves against the onslaught of the Israeli occupation forces, the Israeli offensive forces. And over 2,200 killed, including over 500 children. And the darling of those who continually commemorate and push international commemoration of the Nazi Holocaust against the Jews, the darling of that movement, Elie Wiesel, child survivor of the Holocaust, has come out in so many words and accused Hamas, in effect, not in effect, just outright, sacrificing his children as the ancient Canaanites engaged in child sacrifice. This terrible man who is so deluded by his heartbreaking and truly psychotic rendering experience during the Second World War is just simply coming out and saying, here, Palestine is sacrificing its own children. And he's talking about Israeli soldiers bombing and killing them and burying them under rubble. This is Elie Wiesel's idea of child sacrifice committed by Palestinian Arabs. You're hearing me right, folks. That's what he said. You know, those phone numbers are still open and leading right to the studio here. Line number one. Area code 831-427-3772. You can go to our website at freakradio.org, click on the contact link, and you'll see the phone numbers there, too. 427-3772. Line number two is area 831-469-3119. 469-3119. The lines are open, and the bells are not chiming, though. From Code Pink. Further reminder of the commemoration of what happened last summer. This week marks, this is dated July 9. This week marks the one-year anniversary of the launch of Israel's ruinous assault against the besieged people of Gaza. The third such operation since 2008. And the most devastating, over 2,200 Palestinians were killed during Israel's 50-day military incursion. 547 of the casualties were children. Actually, they use the word casualties. We're talking about 547 killed. 547 kids lost under the age of 18 lost their lives. Many families in Gaza are still living in the rubble of their destroyed homes, and there is little hope of rebuilding while the Israeli blockade of land, sea, and air continues. Today, July 9, in this item from Code Pink. We mark the 10th anniversary of the Palestinian-led Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, BDS. We believe that BDS is the most effective means at our disposal to hold Israel to account for its war crimes. And they are war crimes, make no mistake. As well as for its ongoing land theft, dispossession, and discrimination against Palestinians. Including, I might add, inside Israel itself, discrimination against Palestinians in a variety of interesting ways. Continuing with this notice now, at Code Pink, we've been working to expose real estate giant REMAX for selling illegal Israeli settlements on stolen Palestinian land. That's right, folks, REMAX that we've seen on the TV commercials and on radio, and we've seen their billboards and storefronts in our own country, has been handling the illegal sale of stolen Palestinian property, land, to Jews and Jews only in those illegal exclusive Jewish settlements on militarily occupied land. It's asked here to please take a moment to send a note to the CEO, Chief Executive Officer of REMAX, and tell him to respect international law and immediately halt the sale of illegal Israeli settlements. The growth, the growing strength and power of this global movement has Israeli leaders worried. And just this week, Hillary Clinton paid tribute to our influence in a letter to top donor Chaim Saban, in which she vowed to fight BDS. Talking about Hillary Clinton, just so you understand what we're talking about, let me read that whole paragraph again. The growing strength and power of this global BDS movement has Israeli political leaders worried. And just this week, July 9th, Hillary Clinton paid tribute to our influence in a letter to top donor to Clinton's presidential campaign, Chaim Saban, in which she vowed to fight BDS. She wants that American Jewish and Israeli sponsored money to allow her to make it over the top and win the U.S. presidency. So she's going to pretty much do what Israel wants, including fighting BDS, the perfectly legitimate mechanism for drawing world attention to Israel's discrimination and crimes against the Palestinian people, BDS is, and Hillary wants to fight it so she can garner those donations from her various and sundry Israeli and American Jewish benefactors. Continues to say here, so as we remember those who died in Gaza last summer, we commit ourselves to redouble our efforts on behalf of dignity, equality, and justice. Check out our ongoing boycott campaigns at the following BDS websites: Stolen Beauty, Stop SodaStream, and No Open House on Stolen Land, obviously referring to REMAX, and they want you to send a note to the CEO of REMAX today, even though this email item is over 10 days old. I'm sure you can still add your voice to those who support BDS as a way of bringing the truth out and making it obvious to the world community and fighting Israeli propaganda. I've clicked on a link here. They made a link out of the word worried in the last statement of how Israeli leaders are worried, and indeed that link provides... where did it go? Went to an article on the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. What did you do? Was looking right at it, and then it took itself away from my own sight here. Well, I'm going to have to come back to it because it's fighting me. Yes, computers do seem to have a life of their own, don't they? Okay, here it is again. Haaretz, July 14, which is tomorrow. The headline, growing BDS movement raises alarm among Israeli leaders. With thousands worldwide demonstrating to sever ties with Israel, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, BDS threatens to compromise the Israeli economy and networks of global support. Associated Press, again, this is on Haaretz, as of tomorrow, 10 years ago. A small group of Palestinian activists had a novel idea inspired by the anti-apartheid movement. They called for a global boycott movement against Israel as a nonviolent, I repeat, as a nonviolent method to promote the Palestinian struggle for independence. This, by the way, is written by Tia Goldenberg. Tia Goldenberg, Israel's very own publication, Haaretz. Long confined to the sidelines, the so-called BDS movement appears to be gaining momentum, so much so that Israel has identified it as a strategic threat on a par with Palestinian militant groups and the Iranian nuclear program. While Israel says the movement is rooted in anti-Semitism, its decentralized organization and language calling for universal human rights have proven difficult to counter, resulting in a string of recent victories that have alarmed Israeli leaders. Victories for the purveyors of BDS. Quote, "We are now beginning to harvest the fruits of 10 years of strategic, morally consistent, and undeniably effective BDS campaigning, said Omar Barghouti, one of the group's co-founders. He went on, "BDS is winning the battles for hearts and minds across the world, despite Israel's still hegemonic influence among governments in the U.S. and Europe." End quote. The BDS movement, named for its call for boycotts, divestment, and sanctions against Israel, began as an idea by 170 Palestinian civil society groups, 170 groups, worldwide in 2005. It has grown into a worldwide network of thousands of volunteers lobbying corporations, artists, and academic institutions to sever ties with Israel. Its members include campus activists, church groups, and even liberal American Jews, disillusioned by Israeli policies. Most worrying for Israel, some of the group's core positions toward products made in West Bank settlements are starting to be embraced by European governments. Although the EU, the European Union, says it opposes boycotts of Israel, it is exploring guidelines for labeling settlement products, which many in Israel fear could be a precursor to a full-fledged ban. The significance of that, I will point out here, is that even though the EU says it opposes boycotts of Israel, it's taking a stronger look at examining and clearly identifying products that are Israeli in origin but are manufactured or produced in those Jewish-only settlements, still considered illegal under international law, those settlements that are in the east half of Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, which is considered to be occupied territory by our own U.S. government, still maintained on the records in U.S. international policy as being occupied illegally by Israel, and Jewish settlements in what they refer to as historical ancient Judea and Samaria, or the West Bank, or what is left, if you want to say it's that's what's left of historic Palestine, what should be free Palestine. It's occupied by Israel, and those settlements, which do not belong there, manufactures and produces goods that are often labeled as product of Israel when they're really products of settlements in occupied territory. That's what the EU is talking about in this statement here. They at least want feel that they should identify products that are not produced in Israel proper or behind the green line, as it were, the pre-1967 green line. in Israel, but in territories that are not really, technically not Israeli, not part of Israel to begin with. Okay, let's continue here. Speaking is disillusioned. Yeah, it could be a precursor to a full-fledged ban at a time when peace efforts are frozen and show no sign of getting back on track under a new hardline government, Israeli government. Israelis fear such sentiment will increase. Quote, the concern is that there will be a spillover to a much wider phenomenon that will become mainstream and erode support for Israel, said Emmanuel Nachon of Israel's foreign ministry. The BDS movement has three goals, its own stated goals, I might add, to end Israel's occupation of territories captured in the 1967 Mideast War, to end discrimination suffered by Arab citizens of Israel, and to promote the rights of Palestinian refugees to return to family properties lost in the war surrounding Israel's creation in 1948. For Israel, this last position is nothing less than a call for its destruction. Israel opposes the Palestinian, quote, right of return, saying a massive influx of refugees would mean the end of the country as a Jewish state. The international community favors a two-state solution, quote-unquote, creating a Palestinian state alongside Israel, and even Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has indicated willingness to compromise on the refugee issue under a final peace deal. Under all the other compromises and sacrifices the Palestinians have already made, Palestinian leaders, sadly, still hint at or say outright, okay, we'll let you have this and we'll let Israel have that, and you can continue to take. And for what? For what? There's still no independent Palestinian state. The Israeli military is still present in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. It's present in Syria and Golan Heights, and it is cutting off the Gaza Strip at its land, air, and sea ports of entry, so-called entry, and not allowed, effectively maintaining the Gaza Strip under what is recognized legally as a continued occupation. The Gaza Strip is continuing to be occupied by Israel, according to law. Period. Check it out. Okay, back to the Haaretz article. Barghouti, Omar Barghouti, the BDS guy, a U.S.-educated engineer who also holds a graduate degree at Israel's Tel Aviv University, said the BDS movement is, quote, completely neutral on the political solution to the conflict. But he said he represents the Palestinian consensus, quote, consensus, and any deal that, quote, undermines our basic rights under international law and perpetuates the colonial oppression, end quote, is unacceptable. Any deal with Israel that undermines our rights under law and perpetuates colonial oppression. As for his attendance at a university he asks others to boycott, he said Palestinians cannot possibly observe the same boycott guidelines as asked of internationals, adding that the indigenous population, which, interestingly, that phrase, indigenous population, the author of this Haaretz article chooses to put in quotations, adding that the indigenous population is entitled to all services they can get from the system. Israeli leaders consider the movement to be the latest in a history of antagonists out to destroy the Jewish people. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu recently said, "We are in the midst of a great struggle being waged against the State of Israel, an international campaign to blacken its name," referring to BDS, of course. He also said, "It is not connected to our actions. It is connected to our very existence." It is certainly connected to their actions, I would say. Trying to take attention away from the effective target of BDS. And simply dismiss the purveyors of BDS as a bunch of anti-Semitic, Jew-hating destroyers of Israel. Those are my words. Anyway, going back to the article, the BDS movement is led by a West Bank-based national committee with representatives from around the world, which sets guidelines but allows local branches to decide their own strategy. It focuses on battles with a reasonable chance of success. So some of the biggest companies active in Israel, such as Microsoft and Intel, have not been targeted. Battles have taken place in U.S. food co-ops and city councils. The movement has helped organize several boycotts by U.S. and British academic unions and has made inroads on American campuses. Roughly a dozen student governments have approved divestment proposals. Entertainers including Roger Waters, Elvis Costello, and Lauryn Hill have refused to perform in Israel. The BDS movement also claims responsibility for pressuring some large companies to stop or alter operations in Israel, including carbonated drink maker SodaStream, French construction company Veolia, and international security firm G4S. And I will vouch for the fact that all three of those Israeli areas of developed economy, SodaStream, Veolia, and G4S, or international firms that support Israel, all three of those are marked BDS successes. Continuing, last month, Britain's National Student Union joined the movement. Last week, the top legislative body of the United Church of Christ voted to divest from companies with business in the Israeli-occupied territories, following a similar move by the Presbyterian Church USA last year. The Episcopal Church and Mennonite Church USA also considered divestment proposals recently, with the Episcopals rejecting it and the Mennonites deferring action for 2 years. These things do take time, don't they? Continuing, perhaps the biggest blow was last month's announcement by the chief executive of French mobile phone giant Orange that he wanted to end his partnership with Israeli carrier Partner Communications. He cited his desire to improve business in the Arab world, although chief executive officer Stephanie Richard later traveled to Israel to apologize. Orange and Partner announced plans to unwind their deal. The idea of boycotts is extremely sensitive in Israel. The Nazis launched a nationwide in Germany during the war boycott of Jewish businesses and artists, often accompanied by acts of violence and anti-Semitic slogans, in the 1930s Germany ahead of the Holocaust. In the 1970s and 1980s, Arab countries pressured companies doing business with them to shun Israel. So in the 1970s and 80s, Arab countries pressured companies, non-Arab companies doing business with them, the Arabs, to shun Israel. Currently, Israel is fending off attempts by the boycotters to compare Israeli policies in the West Bank to South African apartheid. That's already quite well established, actually. Continuing, Netanyahu says the attacks on the Jews were always preceded by the slander of the Jews. BDS activists deny being fueled by anti-Semitism, saying that their battle is against Israel, not against Jews. They point to a small but growing number of Jewish supporters, including the Jewish Voice for Peace, whose 9,000 dues-paying members support a boycott of Israel. Naomi Dan, JVP's media coordinator, said the stance stems from frustration over failed U.S.-backed peace efforts. She said that while the group recognizes the Jewish attachment to Israel, it can't come at the expense of Palestinians. It's not about destroying Israel, she said, but full equal rights and a democratic society are more important than preserving the Jewish character of the state. I'll read that again. Full equal rights and a democratic society, a truly democratic society, are more important than preserving the Jewish character of the state. End quote. It remains difficult to quantify the BDS movement's actual achievements, according to this article. Leading global companies, including Microsoft, Google, Apple, and Intel, maintain operations in Israel. Major entertainers, including Paul McCartney, Lady Gaga, Madonna, and Rihanna, or Rihanna, is it, have performed in Israel in recent years. A February report by Israel's finance ministry concluded the BDS movement has had a negligible economic impact. But it outlined some worst-case scenarios, including EU government-led boycotts or cancellation of free trade agreements. Likewise, a recent study by the RAND Corporation said that while the BDS movement, quote, has not yet had a significant negative effect, end quote, on Israel, it is growing. It noted Israeli leaders' fears that it could have substantial detrimental effects on the economy. Last month, Jewish billionaires Sheldon Adelson and Chaim Saban led a Las Vegas fundraiser to fight the BDS movement at U.S. universities. Israel's Justice Minister, Ayelet Shaked, instructed her ministry to prepare legal steps against the movement. This week, Democratic presidential hopeful Hillary Rodham Clinton said she opposed the BDS movement. David Makovsky, a senior fellow at the Washington Policy for Near East Policy and former member of U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry's peace team, David Makovsky, said Israel must show it is serious about the creation of a Palestinian state to slow the momentum. You can reduce its scope, it's a quotation here closing the article, you can reduce its scope, its impact, by making clear when the prime minister says he supports two states for two people, that he is not then going to say Israel will settle in what will be a future Palestinian state, he said. You can reduce its scope, its impact, by making clear when the prime minister says he supports two states for two people, that he is not then going to say Israel will settle in what will be a future Palestinian state. David Makovsky said. Three comments by readers. Tommy says, damn, D-A-M. Siceword says, groundswell. And Bika says, want to know how to stop BDS? Question mark. Is that a question, or did that person stop writing their comment? Okay. A whole article that I actually read on this episode of Mideast Migraines here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. We're pretty much up against the clock here. I want to go ahead and play. Let me see. I think I've got the long version of our. yeah, I've got last week's closing episode of Palestine Today to play for you, which is just over 9 minutes long. So I'm going to call it a day here on FRSC's Mideast Migraines Monday program, Monday edition. Join me next week at 3 p.m. when I'll continue to provide lively readings and interviews, hopefully. I take it for granted people do not want to have to listen to me drone on for the full 2 hours of the program, nearly 2 hours, which has a lot to do with why I'm also playing these interviews, not just any old interviews, but things that are cohesive and have to do with the subject matter. Okay, till next week at 3 p.m. here. And, of course, a continued reading of Christopher Bolin's Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World. We're going to get into the chapter 8, I believe, 8 or 9, which covers the title of the chapter is something like the media cover-up of 9/11. And who is really behind that? That's the weekend edition, Saturday at 11 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time. 11 a.m. on Saturday. Back to that book reading. Thank you very much, and ta-ta.